This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm talking to Margot Peters. She's the author of a biography called Laureen Niedecker, A Poet's Life. Hi, Margot. How are you?
I'm fine, David. Thanks for calling.
Well, I'm really glad to talk to you. And I should say that I read this book, with a great deal of enthusiasm and interest, because Laureen Niedecker has been one of the most important poets in my life, and I just I have to read everything that there is about her, and I really loved this book, and I don't think one has to be a reader of Laureen Niedecker first in order to read her biography, although it probably helps to be a little bit familiar with her work. But I think you did a pretty comprehensive. I can't imagine that there is much that you missed, but which is pretty hard because she was not a well-known public figure, and she lived in a small town in Wisconsin. So maybe you could talk a little bit about what got you interested in Laureen's life, and what prompted you to write the biography.
Well, I went to see a play about Laureen. It was called Niedecker, and it was by a Wisconsin actress, Christine Thatcher, and it was performed at the Horde and also in Milwaukee. I saw it at the Horde Museum in Fort Atkinson. I was fascinated with the play. It has four characters in it, Laureen and her husband Al, her second husband, and two fictional characters. And as I remember, there were some books for sale of Laureen's at the Horde Museum that day, and I bought The Granite Pail, and I read it, and I became a Laureen Niedecker person. I just thought these poems were absolutely wonderful.
Well, they are. I mean, it's hard to believe that she is not well-read and in the canon of American poetry. I still to this day find that hard to believe after all these years. She died in 1970. She wrote pretty steadily from the 30s on, and I know she was obscure, as we would call her, obscure for all of those years, partially because she wrote in as a woman in a time when mostly poets were men, and that there was a certain amount of patriarchal canonizing of poets, but also because she wrote in a kind of writing that was not mainstream. It was, we call it objectivism, although I think she's much more than just an objectivist poet. But in the last 40 years, people have begun to discover her work, and there are so many people who don't know about her. It's kind of stunning still.
It is, but one really crucial thing has happened, and that is that she has, I believe, 16 poems in the latest Norton Anthology of Poetry. And that is absolutely necessary that she be anthologized so that she can be taught in colleges, universities, not high schools probably. But that is such good news.
Oh, I didn't even know that. That's fantastic.
Yeah. No, that it is fantastic.
Right. That does change the one's perception, I think. And
it really does. Emily Dickinson has always been the most anthologized person in any anthology of American poetry. And Laureen is there, definitely there, page after page after page. And Louis Sakovsky, as I recall, has one poem in that Norton anthology.
That's an interesting thing. I think Zukovsky, who was connected to her and which whom you write about, and in a pretty extensively in the book.
One has to. I mean, he's there in her life so long.
Right, and I thought that was very important, the way you recounted what her relationship was with him. I think it was very complicated, and she was I guess one has to assume she was in love with him at one point, and it's very sad that he was such a difficult, self-centered and ungiving person. Whereas she, she consistently was the one who gave in that relationship.
Well, I do think so, David, that he did give, because there are all these letters. Now, so many of them have been destroyed. But I went to Austin, Texas, to the Humanities Research Center there, and there still are. I took 92 pages of notes of his letters that still remain to Nidecker, and they are in fragments, most of them. But he gave. I mean, he never let a poem of hers go unremarked without commenting on it, without encouraging her. He's very encouraging about her poetry. So I don't think he could get very well emotionally. I mean, that was not what he was able to do.
Right. No, and I think that's what, I think intellectually their relationship was actually one of peers in many ways. Initially, she started, I think, as, you know, maybe the younger and a kind of up and coming. But I think as time went on, she became much more clearly his equal intellectually and poetically. But I think in terms of their personal relationship,
The personal relationship was sticky. It was thorny. And he hurt her again and again and again. But he hurt a lot of his friends. You know, she was not special in that particular regard. He had a penchant for quarreling with people. I think the saddest thing when you read in the biography about Nidecker and Zukofsky is when he refuses to write her a preface, for example.
Right, which he refused over and over again.
Which he refused over and over again. I mean, he could have done that. It would not have hurt him, but he is, I don't know. He was a difficult man. I think I agree with Loreen that his short poems are marvelous, are absolutely wonderful. But as a person, I think he was difficult.
Yeah, well, I think she's more a lyricist in her writing. Her writing is more lyrical. It's more, I think she's more available in some ways, which is not to say she's an easier poet, but I think his emotional unavailability and his intellectual brittleness in some ways comes across in his poetry.
And his obscurity. I laugh at William Carlos Williams, you know, who was his good friend, and he said to him, well, you've tried to avoid the ordinary and the mainstream, and he said, you certainly have done it, and the result is that you're incomprehensible. So,
right.
If he could say it. But some of Zukofsky's short poems are very, very fine. But Loreen, I think the impact of her poetry comes from that emotion controlled. It is, you know, so chiseled, so tight, but there's so much emotion there.
Well, and also I think, I mean, we could talk about her work endlessly. I think it's as she called it, the condensery, remarkably able to maintain the power of language with the small number of words she used, and to give so much from within those words. You know, it's not just the shortening itself, but it's that whittling down to what is necessary that she did so well. And plus she experimented over time. She didn't just write one way for her entire life. There's a body of work over time.
Yes, and people tend to call her a poet of place, and that she is certainly, but she's also such a poet of people. She's so fascinated by people, and that you see that from the early New Goose on, in her little portraits of individuals, and then later on, of course, her fascination with Darwin and Thomas Jefferson and William Morris, people like that.
No, that's
she
true.
Lives through other people. Yeah, she's so interested in people's lives.
Well, and also, she was a sort of home, you know, self-taught intellectual as well. Sure.
Yeah, autodidact, really. I
right.
mean. And these people taught her.
That's true. And she thought, I mean, I think that's, it amazes me, her ability to think and understand and do the intellectual work she did without the kind of, I guess we're so used to today that you would have friends or colleagues,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, you'd be at a university, people to talk to, students, colleagues, you know, to other poets, to
yes,
be able to
yes.
give you back, kind of a conversation. And she, I mean, of course, I know she wrote letters to lots of people, but she lived in a place where she was the only intellectual. There was no, almost no one there for her to talk to who could be her equal, who with whom she could show who she really was.
No, I mean, certainly she lacked this commerce between poets, between intellectuals. My goodness, I mean, those were her books. You know, she had to read the books. But until the, let's see, until really the early 60s, she has no one really to talk to except Zhukovsky. And then Sid Corman steps in.
Right.
You know, and there is another voice for her, and a very important one. With his publication Origin, and their letters are very interesting, but so unlike hers to Zhukovsky. But yes, she has no one to talk to except Zhukovsky. I mean, no wonder she says he's a lifeline.
That's true, and she did go to New York to see him, and a number of times. Which, there were things that you talked about in the book that I had not realized. I had this, kind of truncated view of her life, I think, without realizing, some of the
Yes.
things that she was able to do.
Well, she went about a half a dozen times, that's her recollection, to New York.
Right, which gave her a chance to, get outside of Wisconsin and,
Yes.
experience the life, the intellectual life of the city. It's, I think she really liked it.
I think she did. I think she loved meeting people like Charles Reznikoff and oh, who else would she have? She met. She probably met certainly William Carlos Williams, although not under very happy circumstances. She got pregnant, and he was a doctor. But yes, just the widening, the broadening, and this wonderful Diane Deshar, who was Jerry Reisman's cousin, talked to me about their times and how they would go to Bickford's restaurant, and how Lorene was quiet but very much up on things, very intense, very interested, and with a lot to contribute herself. But oh, that must have been just heady for her, you know, absolutely head swirling to sit and talk with people at last. Because who can she talk with in Black Hawk Island, really? There's nobody, as you say.
No, and right, that's true. And the I think you're one of, I guess she must have met the Oppens, George and Mary Oppen,
Yes, she did, the Oppens.
and probably quite a few others. And it was interesting to have. I mean, you did this throughout the book. It was not just with the people that she met in New York, but also you had you interviewed. It sounds like you interviewed people still living in Wisconsin who knew her and could talk about her as. From their direct memories. And there is this consistent portrait of her as being very quiet, but very funny and reserved, but able to come out and talk. I mean, she was not a, I guess you sort of have this idea of the person, that people think of the poet in the garret, that her garret would have been her cabin on the island over the water, and you kind of forget that she was living, a social life at the same time.
I think it's a very important. I think Edwin Hoenig, I don't know how you pronounce that name, Honig.
I think it's
I think
Hanek.
his Hoenig. I think his testimony from the years that she was working in Madison on the WPA, the Writers' Project, funded, you know, by the government. I think those years are so important, and there's not much we know about them. But his portrait of Lorene at the time, funny, amusing, not particularly diffident. Entering, you know, politically savvy, carrying around propaganda for the Marxists, but that didn't last too long. Inviting friends down to Black Hawk Island because she loved Black Hawk Island and she wanted to show the island to all these good friends that she made there. This is a Lorene. You could see what would happen to her if she did get into circumstances with congenial people, which she did there. She was with a congenial group.
Right, I think that must have been pretty also, I don't want to say heady, but also it gave her a chance to be in the world where there were other intellectuals, artists,
Yeah.
the WPA was in Madison is a great, it's a college town, so you're
Oh,
in,
yeah.
you're there with, it's a real intellectual community, and I think that must have been really great. great for her. And I think, you sort of wonder how she felt later, being, because as you point out, and she became, she had trouble being employed. She had her eyes were terrible, and she didn't have a car. She couldn't drive, so she had to walk or get rides, and that, I think, limited her ability to be in the physical world, to go places on her own, but it also limited her ability to get jobs. And she lived in this very, very small, I mean, during the Depression in particular, but even after, she's living in a small town. The opportunities were not great for someone who's not, she wasn't married, so she had to work, and
She
in
wasn't trained professionally in anything, 2 years of college.
Right. Oh, and you sh I, that was another thing. You were great, I think, talking about her time at Beloit.
I really had to dig for that information. There isn't much, but
No, I
yeah,
bet.
I went to Beloit, and the people were so helpful there. But yeah, I think it sheds a little light on her that wasn't shed before. Somebody said to me, "You must be turning over every stone." I said, "Oh, I'm turning over every piece of gravel in my search for Lorene." And as you said, the first thing to do is to interview the people alive who still knew her, because people have a tendency of slipping off before you get to talk with them. So I
Well,
did
that's
quite a bit
true.
of interviewing.
Right, because she died at 67 in 1970, so people who are living today who knew her well as adults would in many cases be fairly.
And yes, most of them are dead, actually. But there still were people that knew her, and that was a great help. So that was the first thing I did. I said, the archives can work. The archives can wait. Let's get to the people who are living and still knew
No,
her.
I'm really glad you did that because, she's a living person, and there's the danger of that all that information disappearing, all that firsthand information, not being part of the record of who she was, and then we end up, and there's nothing wrong with this in the end, in a certain way, if her being is expressed in her writing, she was a writer. So it's okay on some level. I always wonder about how do we really need to know everything about writers or artists? The work comes first, and it
It does.
does,
It certainly does.
and it stands alone. But I think it still is very important to know who the person was, to understand, for ourselves, and also to be able to see how the work. And the person interact or are, it's obviously the same being. And I thought that, her letters are very important in that way because if you read her letters, you can see clearly the link between her style of writing in letters and the style of her writing as a poet.
Well, her letters are wonderful. She's a marvelous letter writer, and she's amusing, and she's casual, and she's intense, and all those things. And that's interesting that you say that you can see the link. Yes, I guess they could not have. Neither could have been written by anybody else except Lorene. She had a distinctive voice in letters, as well.
Right, and she,
Bukowski said, "Your letters are your best work."
right, which I don't agree with, but I think,
No,
I
I don't
think,
agree with it either, but it's a point that she wrote wonderful letters, really.
right, and she wrote, as you said, she wrote about people, and you can see it, in her talking about people in letters, then you think about how she wrote about people in the poems, and some of the poems that they're just incredibly deft and brilliant. In describing her mother or her father, and
Oh,
these
her
are,
mother poems. Oh, my goodness.
they're in, no, they're incredible. And she saw her mother so clearly, and her mother obviously was a major figure in her life. She was a problematical person who was deaf, and it was difficult. I think, it's when you read about her in this book, it's hard not to feel an incredible amount of pain that, kind of sympathetically for her, just because, I mean, there was so many challenges and difficulties in her life. Aside from the personal, it's also that, just the hard, I mean, as we were talking about her work before, I meant to mention that she had to become ultimately, in the end, a cleaning lady. And she worked really hard.
I know.
She had a tough life.
You know, so many people have reacted this way. They've said, oh, I can hardly bear this. It's so sad. Oh, I can't stand it. It's so sad. And I said, I don't think her life is sad. I think a lot of things happened to her. I think the worst, perhaps, was the loneliness. She writes about it so often, David. I never realized before until I started working on this biography how much she talks about loneliness. Loneliness, she says, is such a physical thing. And but I don't find her a sad person at all. I find her tough and capable.
No, I agree with that.
And wiry, wiry. And I love her letters because they show that. They're offhand in a way. They're spontaneous, and they're so honest. There is never any pretense in her. Never, you know?
Well, that's because she wasn't trying to prove anything to an audience. She was writing absolutely accurately for herself. And, you know, she was, you know, I think you have to say she was a pure poet in the sense of not being confused by why she was writing.
And, exactly.
And one of the things, you know, you were talking about her not feeling, being sad. I agree with that. There was a letter that Sid Corman wrote, or this piece that he wrote in Origin years ago, and he said she had ample cause to be self-pitying and bitter, but her letters to me show no trace of either qualification.
No trace. And that to me is the most remarkable thing. And that's why I think, you know, you cannot write this off as a sad, old, small, sad, tiny life. It's a big life because she is big and strong. She is big and strong and flexible and on top of things. I mean, she suffered, but she did not let it defeat her at all.
Right. No, I think it's important you say that because I think there's a tendency to miss and to sort of fall into the trap of thinking that someone who lived isolated from kind of mainstream cultural America was suffering yes, lonely. And I think there's no question that she did suffer. But as you say, I think it's important not to think of her as diminished. And so, I mean, I think there is even people do that with Emily Dickinson, you know, this idea that she, because her world was constrained, that allowed her imagination free flow. And maybe true, but I don't think that you want to look at the person as somehow lesser because they didn't live in the big world. You know, I think we are, it's unavoidably, I think, culturally we're judgmental about people whose experiences are different and think of them as less well-rounded. You know, if you live in a city, you think people in the country live kind of not full lives. And
backward.
And there's no question she lived in a place which was not her intellectual equal, but she herself was a visionary and
absolutely
saw everything.
Well, yes. So enough of this poor Loreen. Oh, poor Loreen. Well, I don't think so.
No, I think you're right. And describing her as tough is accurate. There's that great picture of her that Jonathan Williams took, which is of her in Milwaukee in her later life when she was, and I guess we should say, you know, just she married she had been married early to a very unsuccessful marriage in her 20s, and then again married late in life when to this guy in Milwaukee who was a kind of I think he took care of her. I think he really
I think he was very congenial in many, many ways. You know, obviously, I think Sid Foreman was so right. He said if they had met when they were younger, they couldn't have made a go of it. But by then, they were tolerant enough to put up with each other. You know, I mean, he had to put up with her writing and her absorption in her work, and she had to put up with his bad grammar and his drinking and his. But you know, I think it was a good thing.
I think so. And
this
great picture of her outside the apartment in Milwaukee where she's just staring straight into the camera. This is a tough woman. You know, this is a
stoic
woman.
Right. Stoic and tough, yes.
It's a very Midwestern quality, I think. Again, when you read about the the work that she did every day just to live, which is to, she built this little cabin, or she had, I guess Al, her husband, built the cabin that they lived in. But she had to, they had, she hadn't had running water for years.
Yeah,
That's also.
we have to distinguish between the cabin and the cottage. The cabin was hers. That's the one her father built her
Ah,
out of
that's
a
right.
out of
That's
a
right.
order prefab, and the cabin was hers. The cottage she paid for, but that's the one she lived with near the water
You're
with
right.
Al Millen.
I was mixing the two up. The cabin
It's easy
earlier,
to do.
right? Well, that's where her, you're right. Her father built the cabin, and she lived in that by herself for many, many
Yes,
years. And
absolutely.
that's the one that had no running water until
No
much
running
later.
water. No, right. She had to walk to get water. She had an outhouse. It was primitive, and but it was her house of her own by a willow tree. That wonderful poem. She says, "I'm not happy and I'm not free, but I have a house of my own by a willow tree." And that was right after she published New Goose. And I think she said, "This is my independence. I'm going to get out of this awful marriage that is my parents' marriage, and be by myself and write."
Well, it's you did an amazing job, I think. I think it's difficult to write a biography of someone who's not been alive for this many years, and I think it's also difficult to portray someone who's complicated, and I think you did a great job.
I love doing it. I mean, Nidecker is my favorite poet and my favorite American poet. I have to add that. And I love doing it. I admire her so much, and I feel very close to her. Her philosophers are mine, and her pretty much her views are mine. And so, and then her country is pretty much mine too.
Right. Oh, so, and you live in Wisconsin. Have you always lived in Wisconsin?
I always have. There's something, I don't know, I must be retarded or something, but I've always loved it here. Yes.
And you live, actually, you live near where Laureen lives.
Yes, 12 miles away from Black Hawk Island, right?
Oh, that's great.
And yeah.
And today, in the place where she lived, which is Fort Atkinson, basically, she's pretty well known now. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Yep.
Yeah.
Oh yes. Now she's known. Yes, I did a book signing down in Fort Atkinson, and I thought, oh no, nobody's going to buy this. And I think they sold 70 books in an hour and a half.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah. So Fort Atkinson has embraced her.
And I guess Wisconsin overall?
Yes, and there is now an Laureen Niedecker Wisconsin Poetry Festival in her name. Yes, I think that she is getting where she's supposed to be.
Well, that makes me feel good because I like you, she is my favorite poet, probably for me of all. And I've always loved her work. It's just, I responded to it instantly when I started reading it. I could not believe what I was reading. And then I started reading her in the early 70s. Of course, she was already dead. And I thought, this is just terrible. That she died too young. There was just much more she could have done.
Yes.
A truly wonderful poet. Well, I really enjoyed talking to you, Margot, and
Oh, I.
I want to recommend this book to anybody who's interested in the work of Laureen Niedecker. I think there are now lots of scholarly articles about her and some people who, done great work,
Right.
collecting her poetry. You can find it now. It's available. And as you said, which I had not known, she's in the Norton Anthology. But I think
She
it's
is.
really, really useful to read your no sorry, to read your biography, if you wanted. Really understand the Laureen's life. So, thank you for
Well, we
doing
should
this.
say that the University of Wisconsin Press published it, and they published it last October. Let's see, October 2011, that was. So it is a U University of Wisconsin Press book.
And it's beautifully produced,
Beautifully.
and you have some ex you know great I loved having the photographs, the pictures of her and the place. That really, really brought her to life as well. So, thank you so much for doing
Well,
this.
thank you very, very much, David.
It's been a pleasure talking to you. This is
Likewise.
David Wilk for Writer's Cast. I've been talking to Margot Peters about her biography, Laureen Niedecker, A Poet's Life.